Muad'Dib tells us in A Time of Reflection that his first collisions with Arakeen necessities were the true beginnings of his education. He learned then how to poll the sand for its weather, learned the language of the wind's needles stinging his skin, learned how the nose can buzz with sand itch, and how to gather his body's precious moisture around him to guard it and preserve it. As his eyes assumed the blue of the Ibad, he learned the Chokobsa way. Stilgar's Preface to Muad'Dib, the Man, by the Princess Irulan. Stilgar's troop, returning to the Siege with its two strays from the desert, climbed out of the basin in the waning light of the first moon. The robed figures hurried with the smell of home in their nostrils. Dawn's gray line behind them was brightest at the notch in their horizon calendar that marked the middle of autumn, the month of Caprock. Wind-raked dead leaves strewed the cliff base where the CH children had been gathering them, but the sounds of the troops' passage, except for occasional blunderings by Paul and his mother, could not be distinguished from the natural sounds of the night. This book is continued on Disc 15. Wind-raked dead leaves strewed the cliff base where the CH children had been gathering them, but the sounds of the troops' passage, except for occasional blunderings by Paul and his mother, could not be distinguished from the natural sounds of the night. Paul wiped sweat-caked dust from his forehead, felt a tug at his arm, heard Chaney's voice hissing. "Do as I told you. Bring the fold of your hood down over your forehead. Leave only the eyes exposed. You waste moisture." A whispered command behind them demanded silence. "The desert hears you." A bird chirruped from the rocks high above them. The troop stopped, and Paul sensed abrupt tension. There came a faint thumping from the rocks, a sound no louder than mice jumping in the sand. Again the bird chirruped. A stir passed through the troop's ranks, and again the mouse thumping pecked its way across the sand. Once more, the bird chirruped. The troop resumed its climb up into a crack in the rocks, but there was a stillness of breath about the Fremen now that filled Paul with caution, and he noted covert glances toward Chaney, the way she seemed to withdraw, pulling in upon herself. There was rock underfoot now, a faint gray swishing of robes around them, and Paul sensed a relaxing of discipline, but still that quiet of the person about Chaney and the others. He followed a shadow shape. Up steps, a turn, more steps, into a tunnel, past two moisture-sealed doors and into a globe-lighted narrow passage with yellow rock walls and ceiling. All around him, Paul saw the Fremen throwing back their hoods, removing nose plugs, breathing deeply. Someone sighed. Paul looked for Chaney, found that she had left his side. He was hemmed in by a press of robed bodies. Someone jostled him, said, "Excuse me, Usul." "What a crush! It's always this way." On his left, the narrow bearded face of the one called Farouk turned toward Paul. The stained eye pits and blue darkness of eyes appeared even darker under the yellow globes. "Throw off your hood, Usul," Farouk said. "You're home." And he helped Paul, releasing the hood catch, elbowing a space around them. Paul slipped out his nose plugs, swung the mouth baffle aside. The odor of the place assailed him. Unwashed bodies, distillate esters of reclaimed wastes, everywhere the sour effluvia of humanity, with over it all a turbulence of spice and spice-like harmonics. "Why are we waiting, Farouk?" Paul asked.
"For the Reverend Mother, I think. You heard the message." "Poor Chaney."
"Poor Chaney?" Paul asked himself. He looked around, wondering where she was, where his mother had got to in all this crush. Farouk took a deep breath.
"The smells of home," he said.
Paul saw that the man was enjoying the stink of this air, that there was no irony in his tone. He heard his mother cough then, and her voice came back to him through the press of the troop. "How rich the odors of your CH, Stilgar. I see you do much working with the spice. You make paper, plastics. And isn't that chemical explosives?"
"You know this from what you smell?"
It was another man's voice. And Paul realized she was speaking for his benefit, that she wanted him to make a quick acceptance of this assault on his nostrils. There came a buzz of activity at the head of the troop and a prolonged, indrawn breath that seemed to pass through the Fremen. And Paul heard hushed voices back down the line.
"It's true, then. Liette is dead."
Liette, Paul thought. Then Chaney, daughter of Liette. The pieces fell together in his mind. Liette was the Fremen name of the planetologist. Paul looked at Farouk, asked, "Is it the Liette known as Kynes?"
"There is only one Liette," Farouk said.
Paul turned, stared at the robed back of a Fremen in front of him. "Then Liette Kynes is dead," he thought.
"It was Harkin and treachery," someone hissed. "They made it seem an accident. Lost in the desert. A thopter crash."
Paul felt a burst of anger. The man who had befriended them, helped save them from the Harkonnen hunters, the man who had sent his Fremen cohorts searching for two strays in the desert. Another victim of the Harkonnens.
"Does Usul hunger yet for revenge?" Farouk asked.
Before Paul could answer, there came a low call, and the troop swept forward into a wider chamber, carrying Paul with them. He found himself in an open space confronted by Stilgar and a strange woman wearing a flowing wraparound garment of brilliant orange and green. Her arms were bare to the shoulders, and he could see she wore no stillsuit. Her skin was a pale olive. Dark hair swept back from her high forehead, throwing emphasis on sharp cheekbones and aquiline nose between the dense darkness of her eyes. She turned toward him, and Paul saw golden rings threaded with water tallies dangling from her ears.
"This bested my Jamis," she demanded.
"Be silent, Hera," Stilgar said. "It was Jamis's doing. He invoked the Tahadi al-Burhan."
"He's not but a boy," she said.
She gave her head a sharp shake from side to side, setting the water tallies to jingling.
"My children, made fatherless by another child? Surely 'twas an accident."
"Usul, how many years have you?" Stilgar asked.
15 standard, Paul said. Stilgar swept his eyes over the troop.
"Is there one among you cares to challenge me?"
Silence. Stilgar looked at the woman.
"Until I've learned his weirding ways, I'd not challenge him."
She returned his stare.
"But you saw the stranger woman who went with Chaney to the Reverend Mother?" Stilgar asked. "She's an outfrain Sayedina, mother to this lad. The mother and son are masters of the weirding ways of battle."
"Lisan al-Ghaib," the woman whispered.
Her eyes held awe as she turned them back toward Paul. The legend again, Paul thought.
"Perhaps," Stilgar said. "It hasn't been tested, though."
He returned his attention to Paul.
"Usul, it's our way that you've now the responsibility for Jamis's woman here and for his two sons. His yali, his quarters, are yours. His coffee service is yours. And this, his woman.
Paul studied the woman, wondering, why isn't she mourning her man? Why does she show no hate for me? Abruptly, he saw that the Fremen were staring at him, waiting. Someone whispered, "There's work to do. Say how you accept her." Stilgar said, "Do you accept Hera as woman or servant?"
Hera lifted her arms, turning slowly on one heel. "I am still young, Usel. It's said I still look as young as when I was with Jaoff, before Jaemys bested him."
Jaemys killed another to win her, Paul thought.
Paul said, "If I accept her as servant, may I yet change my mind at a later time?"
"You'd have a year to change your decision," Stilgar said. "After that, she's a free woman to choose as she wishes. Or you could free her to choose for herself at any time. But she's your responsibility, no matter what, for 1 year. And you'll always share some responsibility for the sons of Jaemys."
"I accept her as servant," Paul said.
Hera stamped a foot, shook her shoulders with anger.
"But I'm young."
Stilgar looked at Paul, said, "Caution's a worthy trait in a man who'd lead."
"But I'm young," Hera repeated.
"Be silent," Stilgar commanded. "If a thing has merit, it'll be. Show Usel to his quarters and see he has fresh clothing and a place to rest."
"Oh," she said.
Paul had registered enough of her to have a first approximation. He felt the impatience of the troop, knew many things were being delayed here. He wondered if he dared ask the whereabouts of his mother and Chaney, saw from Stilgar's nervous stance that it would be a mistake. He faced Hera, pitched his voice with tone and tremolo to accent her fear and awe, said, "Show me my quarters, Hera. We will discuss your youth another time." She backed away 2 steps, cast a frightened glance at Stilgar.
"He has the weirding voice," she husked.
"Stilgar," Paul said, "Chaney's father put heavy obligation on me." "If there's anything, it'll be decided in council," Stilgar said.
"You can speak then."
He nodded in dismissal, turned away with the rest of the troop following him. Paul took Hera's arm, noting how cool her flesh seemed, feeling her tremble.
"I'll not harm you, Hera," he said. "Show me our quarters."
And he smoothed his voice with relaxance.
"You'll not cast me out when the year's gone," she said. "I know for true I'm not as young as once I was."
"As long as I live, you'll have a place with me," he said. He released her arm. "Come now, where are our quarters?" She turned, led the way down the passage, turning right into a wide cross tunnel lighted by evenly spaced yellow overhead globes. The stone floor was smooth, swept clean of sand. Paul moved up beside her, studied the aquiline profile as they walked.
"You do not hate me, Hera?"
"Why should I hate you?" She nodded to a cluster of children who stared at them from the raised ledge of a side passage. Paul glimpsed adult shapes behind the children, partly hidden by filmy hangings.
"I bested Jaemys."
"Stilgar said the ceremony was held, and you're a friend of Jaemys." She glanced sidelong at him.
"Stilgar said, you gave moisture to the dead. Is that truth?"
"Yes."
"It's more than I'll do. Can do."
"Don't you mourn him?"
"In the time of mourning, I'll mourn him."
They passed an arched opening. Paul looked through it at men and women working with stand-mounted machinery in a large, bright chamber. There seemed an extra tempo of urgency to them.
"What are they doing in there?" Paul asked.
She glanced back as they passed beyond the arch, said, "They hurry to finish the quota in the plastics shop before we flee. We need many dew collectors for the planting."
"Flee?"
"Until the butchers stop hunting us or are driven from our land." Paul caught himself in a stumble, sensing an arrested instant of time, remembering a fragment, a visual projection of prescience. But it was displaced, like a montage in motion. The bits of his prescient memory were not quite as he remembered them. "The Sardaukar hunt us," he said.
"They'll not find much excepting an empty CH or two," she said.
"And they'll find their share of death in the sand."
"They'll find this place?" he asked.
"Likely."
"Yet we take the time to..."
He motioned with his head toward the arch now far behind them.
"Make dew collectors?"
"The planting goes on."
"What are dew collectors?" he asked.
The glance she turned on him was full of surprise.
"Don't they teach you anything in the... wherever it is you come from?"
"Not about dew collectors."
"Hi," she said, and there was a whole conversation in the one word.
"Well, what are they?"
"Each bush, each weed you see out there in the erg," she said.
"How do you suppose it lives when we leave it?
Each is planted most tenderly in its own little pit. The pits are filled with smooth ovals of chromoplastic. Light turns them white. You can see them glistening in the dawn if you look down from a high place. White reflects. But when old Father Sun departs, the chromoplastic reverts to transparency in the dark. It cools with extreme rapidity. The surface condenses moisture out of the air. That moisture trickles down to keep our plants alive."
"Dew collectors," he muttered, enchanted by the simple beauty of such a scheme.
"I'll mourn, Jameis, in the proper time for it," she said, as though her mind had not left his other question. "He was a good man, Jameis, but quick to anger. A good provider, Jameis, and a wonder with the children. He made no separation between Jaoff's boy, my firstborn, and his own true son. They were equal in his eyes."
She turned a questing stare on Paul.
"Would it be that way with you, Usul?"
"We don't have that problem."
"But if
Hera," she recoiled at the harsh edge in his voice.
They passed another brightly lighted room visible through an arch on their left.
"What's made there?" he asked.
"They repair the weaving machinery," she said. "But it must be dismantled by tonight." She gestured at a tunnel branching to their left. "Through there and beyond, that's food processing and still suit maintenance." She looked at Paul. "Your suit looks new. But if it needs work, I'm good with suits. I work in the factory in season."
They began coming on knots of people now and thicker clusterings of openings in the tunnel's sides. A file of men and women passed them carrying packs that gurgled heavily, the smell of spice strong about them.
"They'll not get our water," Hera said. "Or our spice. You can be sure of that."
Paul glanced at the openings in the tunnel walls, seeing the heavy carpets on the raised ledge, glimpses of rooms with bright fabrics on the walls, piled cushions. People in the openings fell silent at their approach, followed Paul with untamed stares.
"The people find it strange you bested Jameis," Hera said. "Likely you'll have some proving to do when we're settled in a new siege."
"I don't like killing," he said.
Thus Stilgar tells it, she said, but her voice betrayed her disbelief. A shrill chanting grew louder ahead of them. They came to another side opening wider than any of the others Paul had seen. He slowed his pace, staring in at a room crowded with children sitting cross-legged on a maroon-carpeted floor. At a chalkboard against the far wall stood a woman in a yellow wraparound, a projecto stylus in one hand. The board was filled with designs, circles, wedges, and curves, snake tracks and squares, flowing arcs split by parallel lines. The woman pointed to the designs one after the other as fast as she could move the stylus, and the children chanted in rhythm with her moving hand. Paul listened, hearing the voices grow dimmer behind as he moved deeper into the CH with Hera. Tree, the children chanted. Tree, grass, dune, wind, mountain, hill, fire, lightning, rock, rocks, dust, sand, heat, shelter, heat, full, winter, cold, empty, erosion, summer, cavern, day, tension, moon, night, caprock, sand tide, slope, planting, binder. You conduct classes at a time like this? Paul asked. Her face went somber and grief edged her voice. What Liet taught us, we cannot pause an instant in that. Liet, who is dead, must not be forgotten. It's the Chocobsa way. She crossed the tunnel to the left, stepped up onto a ledge, parted gauzy orange hangings, and stood aside. Your Yali is ready for you, Usul. Paul hesitated before joining her on the ledge. He felt a sudden reluctance to be alone with this woman. It came to him that he was surrounded by a way of life that could only be understood by postulating an ecology of ideas and values. He felt that this Fremen world was fishing for him, trying to snare him in its ways. And he knew what lay in that snare. The wild jihad, the religious war he felt he should avoid at any cost. This is your Yali, Hera said. Why do you hesitate? Paul nodded, joined her on the ledge. He lifted the hangings across from her, feeling metal fibers in the fabric, followed her into a short entranceway and then into a larger room, square, about 6 meters to a side. Thick blue carpets on the floor, blue and green fabrics hiding the rock walls, glow globes tuned to yellow overhead bobbing against draped yellow ceiling fabrics. The effect was that of an ancient tent. Hera stood in front of him, left hand on hip, her eyes studying his face. The children are with a friend, she said. They will present themselves later. Paul masked his unease beneath a quick scanning of the room. Thin hangings to the right, he saw, partly concealed a larger room with cushions piled around the walls. He felt a soft breeze from an air duct, saw the outlet cunningly hidden in a pattern of hangings directly ahead of him. Do you wish me to help you remove your stillsuit? Hera asked. No. Thank you. Shall I bring food? Yes. There is a reclamation chamber off the other room, she gestured. For your comfort and convenience when you're out of your stillsuit. You said we have to leave the CH, Paul said. Shouldn't we be packing or something? It will be done in its time, she said. The butchers have yet to penetrate to our region. Still she hesitated, staring at him. What is it? He demanded. You've not the eyes of the Ibad, she said. It's strange, but not entirely unattractive. Get the food, he said. I'm hungry. She smiled at him, a knowing woman's smile that he found disquieting.
I am your servant, she said, and whirled away in one lithe motion, ducking behind a heavy wall hanging that revealed another passage before falling back into place. Feeling angry with himself, Paul brushed through the thin hanging on the right and into the larger room. He stood there a moment, caught by uncertainty. And he wondered where Chaney was. Chaney, who had just lost her father. We are alike in that, he thought. A wailing cry sounded from the outer corridors, its volume muffled by the intervening hangings. It was repeated, a bit more distant. And again. Paul realized someone was calling the time. He focused on the fact that he had seen no clocks. The faint smell of burning creosote bush came to his nostrils, riding on the omnipresent stink of the CH. Paul saw that he had already suppressed the odorous assault on his senses. And he wondered again about his mother, how the moving montage of the future would incorporate her and the daughter she bore. Mutable time awareness danced around him. He shook his head sharply, focusing his attention on the evidences that spoke of profound depth and breadth in this Fremen culture that had swallowed them, with its subtle oddities. He had seen a thing about the caverns and this room, a thing that suggested far greater differences than anything he had yet encountered. There was no sign of a poison snooper here. No indication of their use anywhere in the cave, Warren. Yet he could smell poisons in the CH stench. Strong ones. Common ones. He heard a rustle of hangings, thought it was Hera returning with food, and turned to watch her. Instead, from beneath a displaced pattern of hangings, he saw two young boys, perhaps aged 9 and 10, staring out at him with greedy eyes. Each wore a small kinjal type of kris knife, rested a hand on the hilt. And Paul recalled the stories of the Fremen, that their children fought as ferociously as the adults.